Chapter 2. Wake up, a pope is coming. Do you know what a lion he was, and what it was first like to see him? It was autumn 1978, in the earliest part of the Roman evening. The huge lights of the television networks hurriedly trained on the Vatican balcony as a stranger walked out. What a lion he was, and for all his loving tones, what a roar. John Paul, Johannes Paulus, Giovanni Paolo II, Bishop of Rome, Vicar of Christ, successor to Peter, Supreme Pontiff, servant of the servants of God, Holy Father. One of the longest-serving popes in all of history, whose papacy will be judged by history as bigger than all but a score of the 263 pontiffs before him. Somehow, and it wasn't only a matter of his relative youthfulness, those who were there when he became pope knew he would be with us for a long time. When he went to kiss the new pope's ring moments after John Paul II had been elected, his Polish colleague and occasional antagonist, Cardinal Stefan Wyszyński, said to him, "You will take the church into the third millennium." Then Wyszyński attempted to kneel, but John Paul would not let him, lifting him and embracing him instead. It was October 1978. It was the end of the year of the three popes, and what an amazing time that was. First, Pope Paul VI died. He had been pope from June 21, 1963 until August 6, 1978, a solid 15-year reign. At the end, as his life was leaving him, he'd had a heart attack at the papal summer home, Castel Gandolfo, in the hills beyond Rome. At the end, he made a confession, took communion, and spoke his last words, the Lord's Prayer. He was 80 years old and perhaps not so sad to die. His weariness at the end is reflected in what is probably his most famous comment, that, quote, "In youth the days are short and the years are long, but in old age the years are short and the days are long." He had struggled to guide the church into modernity, and he had followed a tough act. John XXIII, the kindly old pope who'd called and created the Second Vatican Council, burst through a carrying wall of church history and captured the affection of the world. To Paul would fall the hard work of imposing and implementing the myriad decisions, directives, and suggestions of what came to be known as Vatican II. So, Paul VI was mourned, summed up, and buried. He was followed in quick order by John Paul I, the Pope of the Half Moon, who was elected to the papacy by the College of Cardinals on August 26, 1978. Cardinal Albino Luciani, the Archbishop of Venice, had taken for himself the name John Paul I. That was in a nod of fidelity and loyalty to his predecessors, the happy pope and the sadder one. Cardinal Luciani was the last of the acceptable Italians. For 456 years, the cardinals of the church had been picking Italian popes, and tradition in the Vatican is hard to shake. But in the 1970s, the Italian cardinals were split left, right, and center over Vatican II, over how its reforms should be understood and implemented. Cardinal Luciani was seen neither as a liberal nor a conservative. I'm using quotes here in a way because in terms of modern Catholic doctrine and teaching, not to mention practice and local variations and statements on political and economic matters, the meaning of these terms, conservative and liberal, can be maddeningly murky. At any rate, Cardinal Luciani was elected quickly. Now, there had been some talk in the conclave that had made Luciani, John Paul I, of Karol Wojtyła, the brilliant young cardinal from Krakow in Poland. An American reporter had bumped into Cardinal Wojtyła in the Vatican Gardens just before the voting began, and the reporter asked him, "Do you think it possible you will be chosen pope?" The Polish cardinal smiled, and he shook his head, and he replied, in English, "I am not papabile," he said. "I am not a possible pope." In retrospect, it was reminiscent of what he had said 40 years before, when a high school friend asked him if he was thinking of becoming a priest. He had replied very simply, "I am not worthy." So, the new pope, John Paul I, had apparently not wanted the papacy, but he had accepted it. He told friends he was not sure he possessed the physical strength necessary to withstand the pressures of the job. He was a man of considerable humility and sweetness. His father, a migrant worker, had been a Socialist Party organizer. When Luciani was cardinal, he sold the golden cross he wore on his chest to raise money for the needy. At any rate, his fellow cardinals were drawn to his personality and character, and they were pleased, too, by this. After the doer and pale Paul VI, Cardinal Luciani was a man who could encounter the world with a look of pleasure on his face, with a smile. So, the College of Cardinals elected him, disbanded, and everyone went home. John Paul I was just beginning to make a broadly favorable impression when suddenly, on the 34th day of his papacy, early in the morning, a nun went into the papal apartment to wake him, and she found him dead in bed, turned on his side, the reading lights still on, papers spread all around him. He had died of what appeared to be a massive heart attack. He was still wearing his reading glasses. The world was shocked. Popes reigned for decades. They didn't reign for weeks. Soon, and perhaps inevitably, came rumors of foul play. He must have been killed in his bed. Maybe they suffocated him with a pillow. No, it was poison. They did it because he wanted to clean up the Vatican Bank. No, it was because he wanted to reorganize the Curia, so they reorganized him first. The rumors were fueled when it became clear the Vatican had attempted a cover-up of a small detail. A church official had decided it should not become known that it was a woman, a nun, who had found the pope dead in bed. This, even though the papal apartments had long been tended by nuns. The Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Jean Viot, accordingly changed the first official announcements to insist the pope's body had been discovered by John Paul's male secretary, Monsignor John McGee. Two generations of investigative journalists and historians have gone after this story. Not one has been able to come up with evidence supporting the murder theory. And yet the death of John Paul I endures to a degree as a mystery, mostly because of the simple fact of it. How could something so astounding happen? Maybe some of the answer is suggested by a scene in Carl Bernstein and Marco Politti's book on John Paul II called His Holiness. In that book, they recount a dinner that took place a few nights before John Paul I died. He was dining with the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Jean Viot. John Paul is quoted as telling Viot, "Another man better than I could have been chosen, Pope. Paul VI already pointed out his successor. He was sitting just in front of me in the Sistine Chapel." He was referring to Cardinal Wojtyła of Poland. "He will come because I will go," John Paul I said. Many years later, Monsignor McGee would tell this story. When asked what name he would take as Pope, Cardinal Luciani had answered, "John Paul I." When told he could not be called the first until there was a second, Luciani had replied, "He will come soon enough." Here is another intriguing story, this one from the New York Times reporter Tad Schultz's biography of John Paul II. It, too, suggests a certain element of destiny. The elderly Pope Paul VI had known young Cardinal Wojtyła well, and had favored him with important appointments, working with him on the preparation of some of the documents of Vatican II. In this way, Cardinal Wojtyła was given the opportunity not only to do significant and important work, but also to meet most of the movers and shakers of the Church. Schultz reports that Paul VI had wanted Karol Wojtyła to be the first non-Italian pope, and that Cardinal Wojtyła had known this. A strange thing happened when Pope Paul died. Years before, when he was a young man, Paul, then a young priest named Giovanni Battista Mantini, was given his first big assignment as the Vatican's representative in Warsaw. Father Mantini came to have a very special love for Poland and to appreciate its mysticism and respect its literature. This may be in part why, years later, he was so alert to and sensitive to the particular gifts of the young cardinal from Krakow. While he was living in Warsaw, young Father Montini saw in a small store an alarm clock that particularly pleased him. He bought it and he kept it by his bed for the rest of his life. That old clock was at his bedside when Pope Paul died. At the moment he expired, for no apparent reason, the Polish alarm clock went off. It had not been set to go off, but it began to ring loudly as if it were announcing something, as if it were saying, "A Pole is coming, a new day is about to begin." This story is not spoken of much, but has been noted by many of John Paul's biographers. The seemingly unexplainable aspect of it, the perhaps supernatural aspect, seems to have been lost on none of them. So now, John Paul I, the Pope of the Half Moon, was dead, and the cardinals of the church had to gather once again to choose a new one. The phrase of the half moon is St. Malachy's, considered by the somewhat superstitious, the mystically inclined, and maybe by those with too much time on their hands, to have been a saint with a great and specific gift of prophecy. St. Malachy was a 12th century Irish priest who, while visiting Rome, had a startling series of visions, the facts of which he wrote down. In the visions, he was told of every pope who would follow the pope of the time, Celestine II, who died in 1144. Each of the 112 successive popes was foretold to Malachy, who summed up each man with a 3- or 4-word phrase. John Paul I was summed up with the phrase of the half moon. And in fact, he was pope from one half moon to the next. The official church position is that the prophecies of St. Malachy, which were discovered in Vatican archives about 300 years ago, may be a forgery. But the power of the prophecies endures among some of the rank and file, in large part because Malachy's descriptions of each of the popes of the past 300 years has seemed prescient to some degree, and sometimes remarkably so. So it is interesting how St. Malachy characterized the man who would follow the Pope of the Half Moon. Malachy said it would be a man whose papacy would be captured by these words, "of the labors of the sun," which is, of course, the greatest of our stars, and the thing that lights and warms the world. Over 2 days, there were 7 ballots. Each of them had been followed by black smoke issued from the chimney in the Sistine Chapel, where the cardinals met and the voting took place. It was the ancient tradition. Ballots that did not yield a pope were burned in a way that yielded black smoke. Ballots that produced a pope would be burned in a way that sent white smoke wafting. This election was a struggle, but finally the white smoke came. Dusk was falling. The crowd in St. Peter's Square began to grow. They didn't know who the new pope was. They only knew they had one. Sophisticates and writers and journalists stood by with lists in their hands of all the frontrunners. Now it was nighttime, just after dusk, 7:17 p.m., October 16, 1978. The Swiss guards marched onto the square. The papal flag was unfurled from the central loggia of the basilica, directly above the vestibule of St. Peter's. A cardinal of the church came onto the balcony. He began to address the crowd. It was Cardinal Felici, himself said to have been a candidate, but apparently very happy to be about to announce someone else's name. He was excited, and he couldn't help it. He was half shouting. He said the words of old in Latin. He said, "I pronounce to you a great joy. We have a pope. Abemus papam." Those always moving words, that joyous sound, full of portent. "Abemus papam," he said. The crowd roared. And then Cardinal Felici announced the new pope's name, again in Latin. "Carolum Sancte Romane Cardinalem Wojtyła." A friend of mine was there. The moment the cardinal said the name Wojtyła, what followed was not joy, but total confusion. The cardinal had pronounced the name as if it were Wojtyła, and members of the crowd, predominantly Italian, but many others also, they just looked at each other. When you hear some of the broadcast tapes of the announcements, what you hear first is one of the network correspondents and other members of the crowd saying, "Who? Who?" To complicate things further, the name the cardinal said sounded to some like the name of an elderly Italian cardinal who was generally understood to be senile. So part of the muted reaction of the crowd was due to the fact that some of them were thinking, the Vatican has finally gone mad. Now there was new movement on the balcony. A sturdy, round-faced man dressed in white came forward and smiled. The crowd looked up. People pointed. Now they began to applaud. You have to be older than about 30 years of age to remember when we first saw him on the central balcony of St. Peter's Basilica. The balcony faces St. Peter's Square, and on this night there were over 200,000 people waiting to see the new pope. And when they looked up, what they saw was startling. To begin with, he didn't look like Junior Soprano, as a number of the cardinals did and as some previous popes had. He didn't have the big glasses or an aristocratic nose grown fleshy or a peasant's nose grown broad. He looked different. He looked Slavic. He looked young. He was a fit 58 years old. He was the youngest pope in a century, and he looked younger than his age. Solid build, straight posture, 5'11", 170 pounds, steely gray hair, deep blue eyes. He looked robust. Later it became known that he was by nature an athlete. He liked kayaking and biking and swimming and skiing. He was also, it turned out, a published poet and a playwright, who spoke 7 languages fluently. It was all too startling to absorb at first. Word spread in the crowd and finally was repeated on the TV networks. The new pope was the cardinal from Poland, from Krakow. He was from the East, not the West, but popes come from the West. He was from the communist bloc, but popes come from the liberal democracies. He was from Poland. No one comes from Poland. 262 popes came before him, and he was the first from that place. It seemed like a miracle whose meaning you didn't understand. And afterward, the cardinals who had voted for him spoke about this and spoke of the long balloting and the struggle of all of the cardinals to come to grips with the fact that history had taken a swerve. There were no more Italians who seemed right. It was time to have a non-Italian pope, one who was young and talented and deep in his faith, not a bureaucrat or an austere intellectual, but a pope who'd had parish experience, whose career had been essentially to work as a priest and then a bishop with the people. Later, a cardinal would tell Todd Schultz, God forced us to break with history to elect Karol Wojtyła. And now here he was on the Vatican balcony, and he was radiant. You sensed, this man is going to make it all more interesting. His home country was communist-ruled, and communism hates Catholicism. Poland's rulers had tried mightily to repress the church or to co-opt it, but Poles being Poles, it never completely worked. Instead, in Poland, the church was the great counterweight to the state. It was the platform from which the state could be resisted. The crowd in St. Peter's Square still didn't know what to think, and the new pope seemed to understand. In his first words to them, from the balcony, he lauded Jesus Christ, and he praised his predecessor, John Paul I, and then the new pope said, "And now the most eminent cardinals have called a new bishop of Rome. They have called him from a distant country, distant but always so close through the communion in the Christian faith and tradition. I do not know whether I can explain myself well in our Italian language. If I make mistakes, you will correct me. And so I present myself to you all to confess our common faith." It was electric. He was electric. And when they left the square that night, the 200,000 people were not unhappy at what they had seen of this new pontiff. Back in Poland, as word spread of what had happened, people found it impossible to believe. Word came by radio and then spread person to person, and soon half of Krakow was a candlelit street vigil. Communist Party officials found themselves moved as Poles and appalled as communists. In the Polish neighborhoods of America, there was pure joy. In Chicago, in the great Polish-American parishes, people left their houses and they stood in the streets. Then they went to church, and then a lot of tears were shed, and spontaneous dinners sprang up all over town. In Boston, Ray Flynn, an ambitious young politico, a future mayor, and the Clinton-era ambassador to the Holy See, Ray Flynn went straight to the Polish area of South Boston, where people had just heard the news. This is from his memoir. He said, "They were pouring out of their houses, wanting to share their joy, wanting to be together and wanting to celebrate. With no public square in which to congregate, as they might have done back in Poland, they streamed from all directions toward the Church of Our Lady of Częstochowa on Dorchester Avenue." Well, they all brought flowers. They knelt in prayer. He said, "Old women, kerchiefs on their heads, said the rosary as tears of joy lined their faces." There were plenty of men in the church, too. Unlike some other groups, the Polish men didn't leave God to the women only. They said a mass of thanksgiving, and then they had a block party. The new pope settled in. He didn't, as he merrily told people, know exactly how to be pope. So he did things like hold a news conference and then walk through the crowd of journalists taking extra questions and making quips. Then he'd get into a car and tell the driver, "Take me to the hospital." And there he would visit an old friend who'd had a stroke in Rome. And while he was there, he visited all the other sick people, too. Leaving the Vatican, he bumped into the communist mayor of Rome, and he gave him a big hug to the mayor's complete astonishment. And then he announced plans to visit other countries. And yes, of course, he said, he'd like to visit Poland. He would very much like to go home.